say that at the University of Ottawa, we suddenly have a lot of people who are doing research in quantum information and quantum foundations. And sort of somewhat by accident and somewhat on purpose. So part of the on purpose part was they hired this guy who's an expert in quantum nonlinear optics, but also in experiments on entangled systems and quantum information. This is Bob Boyd, he's a CERC, Canada Excellence Research Chair. And then with him, they promised to hire three more people. I'm one of them. This is Ksenia Dolgoleva. So she does research on integrated optics, but wants to do quantum information in them. This is Anne Broadbent, you might be familiar with her. She's from here. So she's starting the math department. And this is Jacob Critch. He does, has a background in quantum information and does theory for quantum biology. And we're hiring one more. And the interviews are about to happen sometime, maybe in the spring or summer. And part of that is that we get this brand new building. And I'm an experimentalist, so we have beautiful labs on the ground floor. It's not going to be as beautiful as this building. I'm sorry. It's hard to match this building. This building looks like an art gallery. But it'll be more of a working experimentalist style building. You know, there's going to be big machines in it that look cool.
Is that a photograph or an artist's rendition?
No, that is an artist's rendition, but it looks like this. It actually looks like this right now. It's going to open in 2 weeks, so it's really close to being done.
Could you just pop your microphone on for me?
Oh, sorry, yeah. Did I not turn that on? There we go. Is that good?
Okay.
Is it on the main campus?
Yeah, it's on the main campus. It's right downtown in Ottawa. And it has... The labs are cut away from the rest of the building, so they're anchored to the bedrocks that are completely vibration insensitive and has pretty incredible air handling systems and things like that. So this experiment, before I forget, I should tell you who did a lot of this work. So in particular, the first experiment was the research and the data taking and the lab building. There was basically no lab when these guys started. It was all three undergrads. So it's kind of impressive. This is Corey Stewart. He's now at U of T. Abed Patel, he's now at Southampton. And Brandon Sutherland, who's at U of T. This is my collaborator in all of this stuff, Charles Bamber. He's still at NRC. Most of this work was at NRC. And this is Rick Gerson, our technician. So I'm going to start off by telling you about that original experiment. Then I'm going to tell you about how we extended it to measurement of mixed quantum states. This is for pure quantum states. And then I'm going to tell you about how that fits into the context of measuring quasi-probability distributions in quantum physics. So this is probably unnecessary for you guys, but we have different viewpoints on what the wave function is. And in fact, I did a survey of many introductory undergrad quantum textbooks, and virtually none of them actually give you a succinct definition of what the wave function is. At best, they say it's what we use to predict the outcome of any possible measurement. So they're sort of defining it in terms of the Born rule. So in fact, some of them even tell you that they're going to define it, and then you try and look for this definition, and they never do. So it's like a bait and switch when they show you the Schrodinger equation. So there's lots of different views. Einstein, had this famous view that the wave function was result of some sort of statistical ignorance of an underlying ensemble of systems. Heisenberg had many different views, but this is one quote from him where he said the wave function represents an observer's knowledge of the system. So that's kind of back in vogue a bit, knowledge relationships. And Bohr was very agnostic in that, at least at one point in time, he said the state function is purely symbolic. So this is, probably you guys know this, but these are the two guys, primary guys behind the Copenhagen interpretation, which Merman from Ashcroft and Merman, the solid state textbook, summarizes shut up and calculate. He's a theorist. I'm an experimentalist, so I say shut up and measure. So that's what I'm going to be talking about in this talk, except there's the no cloning theorem. So you guys probably know this, but I just want to reemphasize, because I've had some criticism that I don't say this enough in my talks, that since you can't copy a single particle's wave function, that's the no cloning theorem, there's a corollary that it's impossible to determine an arbitrary wave function of a single particle. Because if you could copy your wave function, if you could determine your wave function of an the wave function of a particle, an arbitrary wave function of a particle, then you could just create a new particle with the same wave function. And that would be, or two new particles, or three new particles. So that would be ideal cloning, which is impossible. So we do know how to measure the wave function. We've known this for, 20 years now or something. These date back to ideas by Vogel, and first experiments were by Mike Raymer and Konrad Benezek. And these are really just the ideas behind quantum state tomography, in which you measure the wave function. You determine it is you take a whole range of measurements, a whole measurements in many different incompatible bases, and then you you determine the wave function that is most compatible with those measurement results. So again, it's kind of like an inversion of the Born rule. So in this case, we're doing the electric field, and we project onto these phase quadratures, or these electric field quadratures, this red line that's circling around. So we're doing a whole bunch of projections onto different angles here. And we get out through a process called homodyne detection. We get out these histograms, and then we can sort of unfold these histograms and create these maps in phase space. So this would be the real part of the electric field, and that would be the imaginary part of the electric field, or X and P quadratures of the electric field. These are Wigner functions. So you find the Wigner function, or the quantum state, that's most compatible with your data by doing a whole range of measurements. So that's pretty much a standard way to measure wave functions and quantum states in quantum physics nowadays. And it's effective and well-developed. But in some ways, it's indirect. Like, you can't use it as a very succinct definition of what the wave function is, for instance. And there's usually some reconstruction, mathematical reconstruction involved. There's usually, in practice, you are just fitting or optimizing. You're doing an optimization procedure. So,
That technique you just described works fine for mixed states.
Right? Yes, this works fine for mixed states. Yeah. So the wave function, and interrupt me at any time if you have any questions, and I'll go through fast through the parts that I think you know. So if you don't know it, tell me to stop. So the wave function that I'm going to be measuring in this talk is that of a photon, and then the degree of freedom that we're particularly interested in that we're going to measure is the transverse degree of freedom. So your photon is traveling along, and then it has some complex profile in the transverse direction. And so we can say that at any particular point in space, we're going to measure its wave function, so in this plane. And the nice thing about photons is that we can move between making measurements in the momentum basis and the position basis by using a lens. So a lens going one focal length from this plane, and putting a lens and another focal length, the position in this plane gives you the momentum of the photon in this plane, the transverse momentum in this plane. So we can go between making momentum measurements and position measurements. And in fact, the wave function here is the Fourier transform of the wave function here. So the position wave function here is actually the Fourier transform of this one. So it's the momentum wave function, or the wave function in the momentum basis. So we can easily measure this wave function. We can easily put a detector and measure whether the photon is at a particular transverse position. And that would just give you the absolute squared of this thing, the probability of finding it at a particular x. We can do the same thing here, and we find this probability distribution. But you can see the phase of the wave function, which is important for our measurement predictions, doesn't show up. And in fact, you can't get the phase from those two measurements. So you might also ask, could we do what we do for a classical particle and try and measure x and p at the same time, do a joint measurement in the Heisenberg uncertainty relation? I make a distinction here between the relation and principle, because here we're making a measurement on the same every particle. So here, the Heisenberg uncertainty relation stops you from measuring x and p simultaneously. And the way it does that explicitly is if you try to measure x, say, with a slit, the photons would diffract out from that slit, fill up this lens, get collimated, and you come out with completely flat momentum distribution. So here's an explicit example of how measuring x disturbs p. So you can't know x and p at the same time perfectly. That's the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. And this is an example of that. A perfectly reasonable question to ask, and I'm sure many undergrads have asked it, but probably not gotten very sufficient answers is why can't we just measure X gently so that we don't disturb P, and then go on and measure P strongly or normally. So then we're making a joint measurement of X and P, and we're getting some information from it. We're not getting perfect information, but we're getting some information. So a gentle measurement is another name for a weak measurement, or what I'm calling a gentle measurement here is what we call in our field a weak measurement. And weak measurement is in vogue right now. So there's lots of papers coming out about it. It was invented in 1988, by Harnoff and Vaidman. And in particular, they had this paper where they said you could make this measurement on a spin 1/2 particle, and the result of that measurement, the average result of that measurement, could turn out to be 100. So it should only be plus or minus 1/2. That should be its range, and somehow it's coming out to be 100. And because of that paper, a lot of people have rejected weak measurement because, you know, a perfectly natural reaction to this is that, oh, these guys have proposed a measurement that gives us completely nonsensical results, so let's not even think about it as a measurement. So that's a common view of weak measurements in the field, is that they're not actually measurements. They're not proper measurements, and we should just ignore what they're giving us. But it does have this surprising effect that a measurement that's normally bounded to give you a result between minus 1/2 and 1/2 is now 100. So it's a sort of amplification effect. And this amplification effect has actually been used to amplify small effects to the point where we can see them. So Paul Quiot used this in an experiment. It was sort of not the main point of the experiment, but it's interesting that he used it. It got published in Science. So he saw the spin Hall effect. And then later, this was further developed by this fellow, John Hell. I think one of his students came up and gave a talk sometime this year, Kevin? Last year? Anyway. Yeah. In which they use this amplification effect as your primary focus, and you want to use it to amplify small signals in experiments so that you can see them. But that's not what I'm going to talk about today. So to talk about weak measurement, we have to go back to how we think about measurement. So this is a model introduced by von Neumann, in which he wanted to understand how measurement happens by seeing whether you could model the process of measurement, remembering that measurement isn't the collapse, you know, what some people call the collapse, is not in the Schrodinger equation. So it's natural to ask, well, maybe if I just model my measurement apparatus and model how measurement occurs, we can see how collapse could pop out of the Schrodinger equation, right? So this is sort of one step in doing that. So he's modeling his measurement apparatus quantum mechanically and the quantum system quantum mechanically. And, you know, the question is, does collapse pop out of that? Well, it doesn't, and you'll see that in a second. But it still leads to some interesting results. So here we have our system. This is a fuel tank, and it's in a superposition of two different gas levels. That's what I've written down there. And then this is our fuel gauge, empty to full. And now the quantum part is that our pointer on our fuel gauge has some width to it. It has some wave function itself. And you couple your fuel tank to your pointer with a spring, with this interaction Hamiltonian. And the effect of the spring will be to shift this pointer over by an amount that has to do with this this gas height, the fullness of the tank. So what happens in practice is that if you run your system starting off with this superposition through this interaction Hamiltonian, is that you get an entangled state. So when this is high, you have your fuel tank saying it's high. And when this is low, you have this fuel tank saying it's low, and the superposition is maintained. So there's no collapse. So we don't see collapse pointing out of it. But we can now say, okay, now we're going to break this chain of the Schrodinger equation. We're going to actually do a traditional measurement, a strong measurement on our pointers. And on a case-by-case basis, it's going to collapse into one of those two pointer positions. So here's an example where it collapsed into the low, the quarter full position. And here it collapsed to the three quarters. And you can build up a histogram of how many times it collapses in each. And then you can find out where the average position of that histogram is. And this is not obvious to a lot of people. The average position of that histogram on this scale is actually just going to be equal to the expectation value of the thing you're measuring. So usually when you calculate expectation values, you say, oh, I got one quarter this many times, and I got three quarters this many times, and you add it up that way. here you can actually just take it as the average position on the scale. You can, it's pretty trivial to see that they're the same thing, but it's not obvious to everybody. So in weak measurement, we do what you think. We make this weaker. We make the spring weaker. But now it's not able to shift the pointer by as much. So the markings on your scale are very close together. So we're going to zoom in so that the markings are the same as over here. But now on the zoomed in scale, our pointer is much, much broader. And you can say, what happens in this case? Well, if you do this interaction, it turns out, I'm not going to go through the math, but it turns out that the pointer shifts rigidly by a certain amount. And you can, again, measure your pointer, and it'll collapse to different positions. You'll can do it over and over again. You'll get a histogram that follows the shape here. And the key thing is that the peak of this pointer just points to the average value of the observable you're measuring, the gas height in this case. So far, all I've shown you is that weak measurement gives you the same thing as strong measurement. So far, all you've done is sort of throw out information because your pointer is now very wide. So on a trial-by-trial basis, any possible result can come out. It's only on averaging that you can get this expectation value. So you have to run this over and over again on an ensemble of identical systems. If you want to get an expectation value, that's true there too. So the key thing here now is that because we've turned down the spring, you'd expect that we would have not disturbed this superposition as much as in this case. If you think about disturbance as a physical kick, for instance. And so our fuel tank is left in something close to its initial state, psi, which I'm calling psi here. And so we can think about doing subsequent measurements now on it. So say, for instance, we do a subsequent normal measurement of variable B. This could be like the gas temperature or how much it's sloshing around. And we can say, look at only those cases, only that sub-ensemble of our original ensemble of identical systems, all with the same psi, only that sub-ensemble that has result B, we can say, how much does this pointer shift by? And it turns out that, surprisingly, it shifts by something different. It still shifts rigidly. It still maintains its shape as long as the coupling is weak enough. But it shifts by something different. And it shifts by this amount. So this is, the peak here is given by the weak value. So this is the infamous weak value. And you can immediately see why we can get amplification of our average results. So if these two things are orthogonal, then this goes to zero, and this thing becomes large. So that's the amplification idea. But for my talk here, I'm mostly interested in the fact that this thing can be complex, which is also very odd, because usually expectation values are only real. How can this average be complex? Well, you know, your result isn't complex. You don't see an imaginary number on your measurement device. But the real and imaginary parts of this actually have some very simple manifestation. So the real part of the weak value is just equal to the position shift of the pointer. And the imaginary part of this thing is just equal to the momentum shift of the pointer. So how fast is this going? It starts off with zero average momentum, and then it gets kicked by the interaction, and it ends up with some non-zero momentum. So that shift gets you the imaginary part of this thing. So it's very simple in that way. And immediately, we're trying to measure something that's complex. We're trying to measure the wave function. You know, it has a real and imaginary part, and here we have something that gives you a real and imaginary parts. Yep.
What exactly do you mean by average value of A? How is that going to give you like a complex number?
Right. So it means it's exactly what I mean, what I just said. So it's an average because you have to do this over and over again, and you start off with your big ensemble of identical gas tanks, all with the same psi. Then you make a weak measurement of A, and then you do a strong measurement of something else, say temperature, and you only take a particular temperature, 35, only those cases where you got 35 degrees. In that sub-ensemble, you can see where your pointer shifted on average. So that's the average I'm talking about.
How can that be complex if you look at how?
Well, it's complex in exactly this way. It's complex in the fact that its position, so that you can calculate this thing. So this you write out as a Gaussian, and it has, so you know, it's x minus some shift, right? Well, that shift is this number right here. Okay. And it turns out that if you look at what that means, it means that the real part of this thing is a position shift of this pointer, and the imaginary part of this thing, of this number down here, which we call the weak value, is the momentum shift of this pointer. So the pointer starts off standing still, and then after you've done this procedure, on average, it'll be going off in some direction.
So this is another example of kind of anomalous values that, you know, its eigenvalue range typically would be considered to be only real.
Yeah.
The fact that it takes on a complex value is akin to having a spin of 100.
Yeah, that is one. It's a little bit like that, but the amplification comes from the fact that this under a denominator can be a zero. So that really by itself is enough for the weird results.
What happens if you average over all the different Bs?
If you average over all the different Bs, then you just get back to this. Yeah. Yeah.
Who's the first person to talk about complex weak values? Because I guess that wasn't in the original Aharonov, Albert Biden paper.
I don't know who the original person was. It seems like it sort of started slipping into some papers. So Vaidman, never, as far as I can tell from his papers, never liked the fact that this was complex and only ever referred to the real part of the weak value. Not very many people have actually considered we've known what it meant, but not very many people thought of it as the result of the measurement.
So, but I could have written a paper that says, you know, here's a measurement where the result of a spin turns out to be I.
Yeah, you could have.
Yeah.
Okay. It would have probably confused people even more, but. Yeah, so yeah, and you know, as you see from that paper, that's part of the problem with weak measurements. So should we be interpreting this average thing, this thing we're measuring as an average, this weak value, as the expectation value of A? Should we be treating it as a measurement of A by itself? So should we say the spin is 100, or rather maybe we should say we did this weird measurement and we got 100. So part of the controversy, a lot of the controversy about weak measurements is that people interpret it in the same way this is, which is not necessarily the right thing to do. It's interesting to say, you know, to see what it gives you with that perspective, but it's not obvious that that's true. So now I'm going to go on and give you a specific, even more specific example in terms of my actual experiment. So we start off with those photons. We're going to measure its transverse wave function. Now we start off with them polarized in the vertical direction. We're going to make a measurement of whether the photons are at a particular position. So we put a little polarization rotator right there. And if we rotate the photons polarization by 90 degrees at that point, that's a strong measurement because we have a polarizing beam splitter here. And all of those photons that go around it will go off to this detector. And all the photons that go through it we'll go off to this detector, so it completely is unambiguous on a trial-by-trial basis, which is not what we want for a weak measurement. So here, you can think of our pointer as being the polarization, so now it's on a circular scale, not a linear scale. And again, if you scan that and you just add up these results, you'll get just the probability of x, just like you'd expect. For a weak measurement, you just turn down that rotation. So now on a shot-by-shot basis, you get very little information out, because if you rotate a photon by a very small amount, it's neither H nor V, it's some combination of both, so it can go off to either detector. So you're eliminating information, your ability to retrieve information about the system on a shot-by-shot basis. And then, yeah, it goes off to the different detector sometimes. So now, though, since we're interested in small results, we're going to try and measure how much the polarization shifts on average. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to, instead of measuring in the HV basis, we're going to measure in the 45 minus 45 basis. So along these two lines, along our clock, this is our shifted pointer. And we're just going to look at the imbalance along of the signal along those two lines to give us something proportional to the shift. So that'll be true if the shift is small. So this is going to give you, from our theory, the real part of the weak value. So we're doing a weak measurement now, and the average result of it is a weak value. And the real part of the weak value, without doing any subsequent measurements, it's just going to give you the same thing as a strong measurement. So in this case, the probability of finding the particle at a particular x, the wave function absolute squared. So this isn't doing very much for us so far. Instead, now we're going to do a subsequent measurement, And our subsequent measurement is going to be of momentum, because we have that nice lens. And the way we do that is we put a slit in the momentum plane, and we only take those photons with the transverse momenta, say in this case at zero, because this slit is right on axis, but it could be anything. So we're making a measurement of momentum after our weak measurement of position, and we're only taking those photons that had a final value of p equals zero. And now we want to look at both the real and imaginary parts of the weak value. So I've already told you how to get the real part. It's the imbalance of the linear shift. And the imaginary part is the velocity of that pointer going around this clock, or momentum of that pointer going around this clock. So we measure how many photons are going this way and how many photons are going that way. And that imbalance gives us the momentum. That's one way of looking at it. So in optics, though, that entails measuring a difference between your two circular polarization states, left hand and right hand, and that's just going to be proportional to the imaginary part of the weak value. So that's how we get the real and imaginary parts of the weak value in this case when using an internal degree of freedom as its pointer. So with photons, it's hard to interact them with external systems, so we use an internal degree of freedom to make things easier. That's uninvolved with the experiment otherwise. And with that, we can show our result, how we can measure the wave function. So we're measuring this thing. It's a projector onto x. Is the photon at this particular x or not? That's that observable. Our initial state is our unknown wave function. And then we make a strong measurement of momentum, giving us a value small p. This is our weak value formula. Subbing them in, we get this. So you can see if we take, for instance, p equals 0, which is the simplest thing to do, that this thing is just going to be equal to a constant. The thing on the bottom is just the Fourier transform of the wave function evaluated at p equals 0. So that's just a constant. So these two things are just constants. And this is just the wave function in the position basis. So the average result is just equal to some constant times our wave function in the position basis. So it's that simple. And remember that, you know, we know the wave function is normalized, so we can very easily eliminate that constant afterwards. So this is just the last slide, but just showing that now the imbalance in circular polarization is going to give us the imaginary part of the wave function up to some proportionality. And the imbalance in 45 and minus 45 is going to give us the real part of the wave function. So these two different signals, these two signals that are directly on our apparatus, are going to give us the real and imaginary parts of the wave function. So one way of looking at this is that the real and imaginary parts of the wave function are getting transferred to the conjugate variables of the pointer. It's an interesting transformation that only happens on average. So how do we make our photon? So we're going to do this on single photons. So we start off with a bright pump pulse in the blue that has many photons in it. We send it into a nonlinear crystal. They occasionally split up into photon pairs. One's vertically polarized, the other one's horizontally polarized. It's a very rare process, so we usually only produce a pair every 1,000 pulses or something. And then we split them up at a polarizing beam splitter. And because it's only rarely producing pairs, when this detector goes click, we know that this beam has one and only one photon in it. It's called heralding. So this is called spontaneous parametric downconversion, and this is called a heralded single photon source. We then take that single photon, and we want to initialize them so they all have the same transverse wave function. And the only way we know to do that is to filter them. So we send them into a single mode fiber. A single mode fiber only supports one transverse mode, so we throw away all the rest of the photons. They get reflected by the fiber. And that transverse mode is basically something like a Gaussian. It's very close to a Gaussian. So then we send them through our polarizer, and then we get to this lens. And the problem is we actually missed some of our light because you need actually a very good lens to collimate light coming out of a fiber because it's a wide range of angles. And we couldn't find a lens that was good enough that would catch all of the photons. So now at this point, this is where we're going to measure our wave function. We expect a truncated Gaussian because we're truncating it. We put in a mask to limit ourselves to only the horizontal degree of freedom. So, you know, when we're talking about transverse degree of freedom, there's actually x and y. And we're only going to look at x, just to make things simpler. And we have a sliver of quartz that we move across. I'll show you a picture in a second. This is our lens. This is our slit. And now instead of doing two measurements simultaneously, we do them sequentially. So we measure in the circular basis or the 45 minus 45 basis. So we look at those two different signals. This is what our experiment looks like. We'll say anything there. So this is our fibers behind here. This is our polarizer. This is our lens. We don't have the mask in front just so we can see stuff. And then this is our quartz sliver. And we scan it across in this direction in X. And at every X, we make those two difference measurements, one that's going to give us the real part of the wave function, one that's going to give us the imaginary part. So this is the real part that we get. This is the imaginary part. And they didn't look a lot like a truncated Gaussian, which is what I expected. So what we did is we took the absolute square, and indeed, the absolute square, which is supposed to be equal to the probability, does look like a truncated Gaussian. And in fact, it's just these red points. In fact, if you take a detector and you directly scan it across here, you get this black line, and it agrees well with our reconstructed absolute square, the probability of X. So then the question is, why were these distorted? Because this lens was actually specced to be very good, 1 over 100 distortion in lambda. And it turns out that when we look at the phase, if it is coming from that lens, it's not that good. And it turned out we ended up measuring that lens independently, and it wasn't as good as they spec'd. In fact, this manufacturer had specified it incorrectly. So we had diagnosed our lens by looking at our wave function in some ways. So we then wanted to go on to different wave functions. We didn't want to truncate anymore, so we put in this reverse bullseye. So we only take the photons that, this is more transmitting in the middle than at the edges. So now I could show you the real and imaginary parts, but showing at the absolute square here, it follows this thing and the black line. It follows the blue points, and the black line is our directly measured probability. So they seem to follow each other pretty well. And then you can put a glass plate across half of it and start messing around with the phase. So we get a phase discontinuity. And you see that in the real and imaginary parts. And you see it in the phase. But miraculously, because all the photons are transmitted through the glass, you don't see it in the absolute square. So it's just a phase effect solely, except for this little point that gets scattered from the glass edge. And we can put on gradients on our phase. That's a linearly growing phase. It is equivalent to a tilt of your wave function in space. So these are different tilts, and they agreed well with what we expected by our mechanical tilt in our system. And we put different curvatures by moving this lens out, in and out, and these are not fits, they're just what we expect, and then the data points. And you can see they're basically right on top of each other. So that's the first experiment, really. It's showing us that we could make all these sorts of wave functions, and we could measure them, as far as we could tell, accurately. So we could put on phase gradients and stuff, and it seemed to measure them accurately. So why do we call it direct? Well, it's really in comparison to state tomography. So we call it direct because it's local. It measures the wave function at one point. In state tomography, you do a global reconstruction of it. You take all your data, and then you do a fitting. So that's one reason. There's no mathematical reconstruction involved. It's just those two numbers, and they appear right on our apparatus. So in that way, it's direct. Finally, it's direct in that it's very simple. So you just measure X and then P. So these are the four ways in which we've identified in which we can call it direct in comparison to standard ways of measuring your quantum state. Another way of looking at it is an analogy with how electric and magnetic fields were understood when they were first introduced, and that is in terms of test particles. So people were very confused about what electric and magnetic fields were when they were first introduced. And some clarity came about by introducing the concept of test particles, which are particles which you take the mass and the charge and the dipole to zero. And then you see that theoretically and even experimentally, they follow the field line. So it gave us a way to conceptualize these fields. And here's some iron filings following a magnetic field. And here's some grass seeds following an electric field. In this case, we're taking the strength of the measurement to zero, and we're getting a way of conceptualizing the wave function. And another way of looking at it is as an operational definition for the wave function. So operational definitions have been popular in physics since Einstein came up with special relativity from thinking about what operations you would do to synchronize clocks using light. And because this identified a gap in our understanding of physics, people have come back again and again to operational ways of defining things to gain some sort of understanding, some concrete grounding for their understanding of things. So in this case, I would contend that there's no current definition of the wave function, at least nothing succinct. And we can get some clarity, perhaps. I haven't really pushed this very far, this idea. But we can get some clarity by a set of operations used in the lab to measure it. And in this case, you define the wave function as the average result of a weak measurement of a variable followed by a strong measurement of a complementary variable. So I've left that very generic, not in terms of X and P, because this is really is a generic idea. It's true for any two complementary variables. It works out very simply for, say, spin X, spin Y, or frequency and time for the photon. And in particular, you can even do it for entangled particles. So here's an experiment that I did while I was in grad school that we didn't think of as measuring the wave function, but it turns out that's exactly what we were doing. We start off with an entangled state. This is called Hardy's paradox, but you end up with this entangled state. So these are the inner arm of the left interferometer and the outer arm of the right interferometer. So we have two particles, and that's where they are. And these are the amplitudes up to a normalization. So this is the theoretical quantum state. And so you can ask, can we weakly measure where those particles are in that system? And it turns out the measurements we were doing, the post-selected measurements, the final strong measurement, was exactly the type of measurement we wanted to do. It was a superposition of those two arms. So it was like the complementary basis of where are the particles. We were measuring in a basis that was a superposition. So we're trying to measure things like where are the pair of particles. And I won't go into the details, but that's what we did. We measured these weak values, and these give you the coefficients in the state. So it works in discrete systems, it works in entangled systems. We didn't get the best values, but it in particular, we got a negative where we should. So it works theoretically and even experimentally in entangled systems. So so I think I've said most of the things in this summary. So I'll just go on quickly to the second part. I don't know what this clock is.
You got 20 minutes.
20 minutes? Okay. So that's okay. So that sort of ends the experiment that was published in Nature. Are there any questions at this point? It's probably a good point to ask. Yeah?
You keep saying that this was a measurement of the expectation of position in the real part and expectation of momentum in the imaginary part.
Of the pointer, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, of the pointer. Because I was thinking that the observable you're measuring on the system is actually, you know, the projector onto, you know, this position eigenstate. So it's a binary. It's a two
yes.
eigenvalue observable.
Yes.
And so if I measure all of those, then yes, I've also measured the total position observable.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see how, you know, strictly speaking, you know, one run of the experiment where you've got the thing in a particular position measures that binary observable.
Yeah.
What is not so clear is how, you know, when I measure other binary observables corresponding to the circular polarization basis, that's sort of like a, you know, think of that as a qubit. It's another basis of the qubit. And I just don't see how sort of measuring those local observables on all the points sort of maps on to the momentum observable. So what's the connection between the overall momentum observable, which has a continuous spectrum, and these local observables, which have binary spectrums?
Well, think back to the example of the gas tank, right? It was in binary, but it was a discrete observable. Like the gas tank had particular gas levels that you could measure.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you're right. That could be continuous too. But the pointer is still continuous. There's no reason why you can't couple a continuous system to a discrete observable, if that's what you're asking.
No, I'm not troubled by that. I'm
getting a little confused about which, because there's lots of different momentums. There's the momentum of the pointer and position of the pointer, and then there's the position of the system and the momentum of the system.
So I'm talking about the properties of the system itself.
Okay.
And so when we talk about position, I could say, well, one way of measuring the position observable, which is a continuous spectrum, is to measure the following infinite set of binary observables.
Yes.
Is it here or not? Is it here
yes,
or not?
Yes, and that's what
is
we're doing, yeah.
Exactly. And then you measure, you know, once you got the expectation values of all those, you can infer what the expectation value of the overall position is.
Yeah, but we're not interested in the overall expectation value. We're just interested in those individual ones. Because
okay.
those each at each position, that gives us the value, the real and imaginary parts of the wave function.
Right.
Yeah. So we're not interested in the overall position. I think the overall position would be just the expectation value of x. I'm not entirely sure, actually. Probably not.
So let me say that if I can rephrase my question.
Yeah.
What's not clear to me is, you know, when you infer the imaginary part of the wave function at position x naught.
Yes.
That's again a binary observable, so it's clearly not the momentum observable, which has a continuous spectrum. What observable is it? That's what's just not clear. Like, you know, I can sort of see how locally I'm.
Are you asking what observable corresponds?
Of the system is that imaginary part of the wave function.
Oh, I
at
see.
A position tracking.
Well, I think that, okay, so that's a good question, and I think that's part of the reasons why people have had a hard time getting their heads around weak measurement is that there is no. I don't think anybody's written out exactly the connection there. Andrew Jordan does have something that writes down POVMs for these things. So that kind of gets you a little bit there. But part of the distinction is that we're not interested in what the projectors are. We're interested in what the average values are. It's very different than in quantum information, where you're almost always interested in what you're getting out on a trial-by-trial basis. In this case, we're not at all. We're only interested in the average results. I think that's part of the reasons why this is confusing to people. So the short answer is I don't know what the operator corresponding to the imaginary part of the wave function is at that point.
It's also that when you measure the real part of the wave function, that's not giving you the magnitude squared of the wave function.
Yeah.
That's just giving you the real part of the wave function.
Yeah, that's right.
When you measure the complex part with the circular polarization, that's just giving you the complex part.
Yes.
You have to square those and add.
To get the absolute,
yeah, the absolute
value.
So this point of view that there's a sort of binary observable isn't, I don't understand.
Definitely the thing that we imagine ourselves coupling to in this von Neumann picture is a binary observable. It either is or isn't at this particular position. But what the actual POVM that describes the entire measurement process that leads to this imaginary to the imbalance in the circular polarizations, I think that's not so obvious. But maybe I think Andrew Jordan has shown what it is.
You could summarize my question as follows. You know, the real amplitude of the wave function is the weak value of the binary observable projector onto position x naught.
Right.
And that has eigenvalue 0 or 1. So it's the weak value of a binary observable, the real part of the wave function. And I just want to know, what is the binary observable of which the imaginary part of the wave function is the weak value?
If you write the wave function down, it's just coarse-grained at the level of this x measurements, then each term in that wave function will have a number in front of it, which is a complex number.
Yes.
Which will, you know, will have a real part and an imaginary part.
Yes.
So I don't see how are the real and imaginary on the job.
I think you've identified the real part even incorrectly. Like, I'm not sure that's the observable that corresponds to the real part.
Isn't that your claim on the overhead that, you know, what you're measuring is the weak value of observable A, and observable A is the projector onto X, where X naught is the position where you're.
I didn't claim that. No.
Oh, okay.
I claim that we are doing this, and this gives us the wave function. I didn't claim that the observable that we're actually measuring is we're weakly measuring this observable, and what comes out is the wave function. I'm kind of agnostic about how it happens. That's basically all I say. Let me go on and my oh Kevin.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So the wave functions, if you multiply it by a global phase, you don't change any of the physics, right?
Right.
But you've got one. This must have come up, right?
Yes.
You've got one particular value
phase,
that comes
yeah.
out of your experiment. So
yeah.
How do you get around that? Like, what's the
How do you get around that?
Is there
Why would you want to get around that? Global phase doesn't matter. So, but it does have a meaning in our experiment. If
okay.
that's what you're asking, like how yeah. the phase is set. I mean, it's basically set by the post selection. So the post selection, the thing on the bottom, is also a complex number, and so you know it will be arbitrary from one wave function to another. It'll be different, that global phase, but. Because it is arbitrary, you don't really care. The other thing is that, you know, the wave function phase depends on your frame. That actually shows up in our measurement too, because if you take the if you don't take p equals zero, and you take p non-zero, then you actually get this additional linear gradient across your wave function. So that's where so it's also that's how that comes in. So maybe this part might either confuse you or answer some of your questions. I'm not too sure. But one of the criticisms of that original experiment was that it doesn't work for mixed states. So my first question was, is there a signature that you have a mixed state in your system? And there might be, but it's going to be very weak. It's going to be, you know, we've already made our pointer very broad, and it'll be noise on that pointer. So it's true. In our original experiment, you wouldn't even really be able to notice that you had a mixed state properly. But it turns out that if you just post select, not on, if you take every possible momentum and look at the correlation between your x measurement and that every possible momentum or each momentum, look at those two displacements, the circular and 45 minus 45 differences, then that is enough information to characterize any mixed state. And it turns out that this thing gives you a complex number. Now we have a two-dimensional function, x and p. So I said, well, this is a weird thing. This is a complex quasi-probability distribution to describe your state. And I started looking in the literature to see if anybody else had talked about this. And it took until I found some people referencing this paper by Dirac that I found out what it was. So it turns out if you post-select on all the subsequent p, your strong measurement no longer only takes one p, but you look at all the possible p as results. And you're measuring this thing, the Dirac distribution. And the Dirac distribution is complex. And it was introduced by Dirac explicitly as an analogy between classical and quantum mechanics, at the same time that Moyle was trying to tell him about the Wigner function, and Dirac was telling Moyle that that was a stupid idea. So there's these correspondence back and forth between them. So Dirac was ignoring history, the fact that there was already a good description analogy between quantum and classical mechanics. And he came up with his own one, this one, for operators. In this case, the operator is the density matrix. Problem is the observable that you want to measure is this thing here. And that's non-Hermitian. But interestingly, this is exactly what we can measure in our experiment. We can measure the weak average of any two observables. And I call it a weak average now because we're not doing that post-selection. There's no denominator now. So our results can't become really huge, but they're still complex. Right, so that gives you if you just take the trace of that in your state, that gives you this thing that Dirac proposed. So how are we going to measure it? Well, it's basically the same experiment. Now we need to make mixed states. We have a vibrating glass plate over half of our beam right before our mask. So that gives us some phase noise. And now we need to post-select on all the final momenta. So now we have a camera here. And so we have these wave plates that we can measure in the circular basis, left-hand circular, project onto it, and right-hand circular, minus 45, plus 45. And we measure these differences in rates at the pixels. So at a particular pixel in the horizontal direction, that'll correspond to a particular p. We measure the number of photons at 45 degrees, and then minus 45 degrees. And that gives us something proportional to the Dirac distribution, what I call the Dirac distribution, up to the strength of the measurement. This is the rotation of the polarization. So it's not a weak value. This is something kind of new because it's not post-selected on one value. It no longer has that denominator, but it's still complex. So it's kind of interesting that you still get these complex values out even though you don't have that post-selection. What do we measure? Well, we measure a real and imaginary part just like we did before, but now they're two-dimensional. I write it in terms of k because it's just simpler to think about k is equal to h bar p. It's still transverse. In a pure state, you can just write it out as the wave function times this Fourier transform times this phase, and this is what we get. We aren't vibrating the glass plate here, but you can see it's kind of hard to see actually in this picture, but you get a phase discontinuity. You do get a phase jump here, but you don't get a phase discontinuity. There's still a relationship between both sides of the glass plate. And then when we start vibrating the glass plate, first thing you notice is this thing becomes lower and gets more broader. In K, and that's because you've decohered the two halves of your wave function in position space. So momentum space, now you're going to get something broader, because that's how the Fourier transform works. It's like taking a Fourier transform of two things that are narrower. So now you get something broader in k-phase. And you can also see there's a phase discontinuity in there. That's just due to the fact that there's no phase relationship between these two beams. Effectively, you multiply this thing here, your mixture of states, by this sort of phase encoding that lets you see phase discontinuities and the loss of phase relationships. So it's a way of visualizing your state. And it can represent pure and imaginary states. And the nice thing is it's very simply related to the density matrix. You just get rid of that phase encoding, just multiply it out again, take the Fourier transform, and then you get your density matrices in the position basis. So this is with the glass plate still. So you have phase coherence between the different sides of the glass here. And then this is the real and imaginary parts. And then in the mixed case, you get no phase coherence. The off-diagonal terms between the two halves of the wave function are zero. It's beautiful. So we've measured our density matrix and also the Dirac distribution. So this has a relation, this learning this relationship to the Dirac distribution has also led me on a trail that showed me that, in fact, our measurement of the wave function is not so removed from those state tomography ideas that I first told you about, where they measured the Wigner function. And this comes about from a general, so I'll just, you guys might know this, but we have the Wigner function, which for a coherent state looks like this, and for a single photon state looks like this. These are all quasi-probability distributions, so they're sort of as close as we can assert to a probability for a quantum particle in phase space. So here X and P is what we call phase space. So it's like a probability distribution, but it can go negative for quantum states. And then we have the Hassimi distribution, the Q function, which is a projection onto coherent states. This is the same single photon state. That's a coherent state. It's broader. The marginals are not correct, so that's what's not nice about that one. And then the Glauber distribution, or the P function, which is expansion of your density matrix in terms of a basis of coherent states. There, a coherent state is just a spike. It's a Dirac delta function in space. And anything more quantum than that doesn't have a very nicely behaved distribution. So that's a quick introduction to quantum quasi-probability distributions in quantum optics. There's the Q, P, and Wigner. What are these? They're all related because they're all just different ways of writing your density matrix in different operator orderings. So you take your density matrix, you expand it in a particular ordering. I'll explain what that means in a second. And then you take your A's, your annihilation operators, replace them with alphas, which is just a C number, and the same thing there. And then the result will be whatever your quasi-probability distribution is. So if you used a symmetric ordering, you get the Wigner function for your density matrix. If you use the antinormal ordering, you get the Hassimi function, the Q function. And if you use the normal ordering, you get the P function. I guess I should have had that up when I was showing you. So here, this shows you what the orderings are. It just means you put all the A's to the left of your A daggers, and evenly weighted sum of orderings, and vice versa. So this is the point that I'd like to get across here, this slide. And you don't see this in textbooks, as far as I know, at least not ones I've seen. But from an experimentalist standpoint, it's the best way of looking at quasi-probability distributions. And that is, all quasi-probability distributions, all of these ones, can be thought of as a result of the problem of translating a classical measurement into a quantum measurement. So the classical measurement of measuring, classical way of measuring a phase-space distribution, a Liouville distribution, is measuring whether a particle, is at a particular position in phase-space, XP, so you're doing this measurement, and then rastering it. That's one way of thinking about it. Just measuring how many times you get a result at each one of those positions in phase space, and you build up a histogram, which is your probability distribution. So that looks like a Dirac delta, two-dimensional Dirac delta function in phase space, and it's a little point there. But to translate that into quantum physics, you have to make a choice of operator orderings. So that's what I mean by writing it in these squiggly brackets and writing this O bar. So that's our operator ordering in this case. And so now it becomes this operator delta, a point operator. But the observable is no longer a simple Dirac delta function. And now, measuring our quasi-probability distributions, or even defining them, corresponds to just taking the expectation value of that operator, this point operator, this direct delta distribution translated to quantum physics. So the Q function, that point operator, is just a projection onto coherent states. The Wigner function, it's a parity operator about a point in space. So that's kind of a weird thing. This you can kind of imagine, because a coherent state is kind of like a smeared out point in phase space. So you can see why that would be like measuring this point classically. This one's not so clear. And then the P function, there is no observable. It's not physical. So there is no way of measuring it. So experimentally, these actually correspond to the measurements you would like to do in the lab to directly measure all of these quasi-probability distributions. So we can measure this one by an Aport Homodyne device, or by Heterodyne, that was proposed by Shapiro and Nguyen. Parity measurements were done by Konrad Benezek, on the electric field, that is. Konrad Benezek, Hirosh, Silberhorn, Smith. And so that lets you measure the quantum state, the Wigner function of the electric field directly, just by counting photon numbers, for instance. And in the P function, you just can't measure because there's no observable. So this brings us back to the Dirac distribution. In this case, we've left out one ordering, probably the most obvious one. Instead of ordering A's and A daggers, let's order actual observables, things we can observe, X and P's. These are called the standard and anti-standard orderings. So you can imagine that a Dirac, I did write it out. So here, we want to order our two-dimensional Dirac delta function in the standard ordering, so X to the left of P, except I've gotten it backwards, I think. So you can just write this out as two product of two Dirac distributions and keep it in the right ordering. And a Dirac distribution in quantum mechanics is just equal to a projector. And you can show that rigorously. I'm not just writing it down. So this is just equal to this product of two projectors. So that's the thing that we want to measure the Dirac distribution. And it's just another form of quasi-probability distribution. So there I just show that measuring the trace of that, just like you'd measure the trace of those other projectors, just gives you the Dirac distribution. So the standard order distribution is the Dirac distribution. It has some nice features. The expectation values, just like the other quasi-probability distributions, is just an overlap integral, just like you do in classical physics. But here you integrate the anti-standard and standard distributions against each other. So this would be anti-standard for your observable, and this would be standard for your state, and then that would give you the expectation value of your observable B. That's true for P and Q as well. You have to use the opposite ones. And the marginals are nice. They're equal to the probability distribution of X and the probability of distribution of P. So it has nice marginals. So even though it's complex, when you look at the marginals, if you integrate over one of the degrees of freedom, the other one is the probability distribution, just like you'd like. I'll just skip through this part because it's a little bit complicated. But another nice thing about it, and it was shown by Holger Hoffman in Japan, was that these Dirac distributions actually propagate via Bayes' law. So you can come up with a sort of analogy of translation of Bayes' law that'll propagate in time or in space or via any kind of evolution how these Dirac distributions transform. And so you just generalize your definition of the Dirac distribution. You have more delta functions. These all turn into projectors. This is just starting off our generalization. So now we have a four variable joint probability distribution. And we use Bayes' law to propagate the Dirac distribution. So we start off by saying this. So we sum over these two variables gives us our two new variables. And then rewriting this using Bayes' law, you get that. And then you can just, again, use that to define your conditional probability. And the nice thing about your conditional probability, so we define it using the Dirac distribution, and then this definition up here, to sub in all those projectors, is the state cancels out. So this thing, and doing the sum, takes us from one Dirac distribution to another. I think I made a mistake there. That should be Q. From one Dirac distribution to another, it could be in a different time, it could be just a change of basis, whatever you want. And this thing here, it doesn't have any state in it. It's just a overlaps of basis states. And this is basically the same thing as a super operator, and if you're familiar with that from quantum evolution. So this is a way of translating our state, of evolving our state. And it just follows from Bayes' law. And then, 5 minutes? Okay, I'm pretty much done. So this is a experimental results that show that. So we wanted to show that it actually works. We only updated one of our variables in our direct distribution. So here we're starting with XP. We're going to go to this XK prime. So we didn't want to update both variables in our distribution, just wanted to keep it easy. So that corresponds to just moving our camera back. So we're not measuring in the momentum plane. We're letting our state evolve a little bit more in time or in space as it propagates. And so now we're measuring a sort of a hybrid of X and P. If you know about optics, if you move out of the focal plane, you start measuring hybrid operators of X position and momentum. So we move it back by a particular Z, and then we measure it directly, just the way I told you, by those two imbalance signals. And then we predict it theoretically from our original one using this propagator. So this is what we get experimentally. So this is our original one. And then we move the camera back a little bit and it gets a little bit more spread out, just like you expect light to do. It diffracts out, gets more and more diffracted. We didn't expect this. The two lobes actually start shifting off each other in space or in this hybrid variable. And we think it's just because our glass plate must have had some wedge to it. But theoretically, it actually pops out, just like we'd expect. So you can just calculate this from first principles and then apply it to this original one to get these guys. Actually, I think this one is even evolved from the one I showed you on the other page. So we actually had four different points. So it seems to work well, this Bayes law propagating of our direct distribution. And you might ask, well, again, how is this related to our original wave function measurement? Well, if you take a stripe through our direct distribution at p equals 0 or k equals 0, you again get back out your wave function, your truncated Gaussian. So like the Wigner function and the Q and P functions, the Dirac distribution is an example of an ordered quasi-probability distribution. There's a unified way to look at these measurements. And it's a directly measured in a particularly straightforward way. We weakly measure X and then strongly measure P. So it's like measuring a point in phase space, right? We just like to measure X and P, and we do that. But we do the first part of that gently. And just like a classical Louisville distribution, it can be propagated via Bayes law, although it's a complex analogy to Bayes law. And finally, I should say that there's no reason why that second measurement has to be strong. It could be weak too. And then you have two weak measurements in a row, so you don't disturb your system, or you can minimize how much you disturb your system. So you can think about using this to interrogate systems that are fragile, like quantum states in quantum computers or atomic clouds or things like that, and determine their states while they're evolving, on average, that is. And that's it. I'm done. Thank you.
Questions?
Have you considered the efficiency of this weak tomography and the state tomography?
Comparing the two. When I first did this experiment, I presumed that this would be less efficient per particle that you measured or had in your original ensemble than state tomography. But some recent results on weak measurement have made me reconsider that, and we're examining that question theoretically at the moment. So it could turn out that it actually is as efficient as state tomography. I'd be surprised, but we're going to look into it.
Have you developed a general theory for the entangled case? Give me an example, but have you developed the general?
Well, I mean, in some ways, the Nature paper has the general theory in it, because we give it for a continuous state, continuous variable, and then we give the formulas again for a discrete system, and an entangled system is just a specific example of a discrete system. But so no, we haven't like explicitly shown it for entangled systems because it kind of just follows, as far as I could see anyway.
Can you go back to the bit where you introduced the momentum measurement for
way
measuring
back
the Dirac distribution? So you said,
oh,
in that case, you're not just going to look at the center of the screen, but you know you're going to filter all possibilities in the Fourier plane.
Okay, Yes, like this one? Where?
Yeah, I think
this shows you how it happens anyway.
So it.
Or that one?
What wasn't quite clear to me is why this is no longer post-selecting. It sort of sounded at first that you're just going to say, we'll post-select on p=0, and then we'll post-select on p=1, and so on.
It is post-selecting in that sense. It's just that what some people mean by post-selecting is that you take one of all the possible results, or two. Instead, calling it a post-selection is not really quite the right terminology, because if you were doing a joint measurement and they're both strong, you would always take all the possible results and look at correlations between them. That's how you do it. So calling it post-selection is a little bit of an unnecessary step. You're looking at the correlations between all your possible results. Like if you're looking at Bell states and you're trying to do a Bell's inequality, you're looking at Sx of particle 1 and Sy of particle 2. And the way to figure that out is you find out how many times you have -1/2 on this side and -1/2 on that side, and you add that up, and that's all we're doing essentially.
So maybe can you explain why is there no longer a denominator? Because I sort of imagine you're going to be looking at many different weak values for all these different possible post-selection. And so I was sort of expecting that every bit of the data analysis would have the denominator still there.
Is there an easy, let me think about this. The only reason why the denominator is there, okay, you can imagine even in the weak value case, that you can, instead of asking how much does this pointer shift by, right? You could ask how many times you get the plus measurement and how many times you get the minus measurement, or 45 minus 45, right? That's what we're looking at, is that just those numbers basically. So we no longer have to, since we're no longer looking at how big the shift is, we don't have to divide by how many times it comes out. So in other words, we're looking, in some ways, because you're post-selecting in the weak value case, that's why you have to divide. And in our case, you don't have to divide because you're just looking at correlations between your position measurement and your p measurement on a point-by-point basis. We're looking at, I can use these blackboards, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So. So in the weak measurement case, you're looking at something like px equals, or big x equals small x, given that big p equals small p. So just by Bayes' law, you expect that to have a denominator, right? By p, this is equal to p small x small p divided by. So that's the denominator that comes into, essentially, that comes into the weak value. And we're just looking at p small x small p. That's what we're looking at. So that's why it doesn't come in. This is essentially what we're measuring. So that's why it is the joint probability distribution. It's our attempt to measure that thing.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
Welcome.